Hello and welcome to this 2012 Telesummit call with Susanna Harwood Rubin. This is your host, Tal Ratcliffe, and this call is about why myth matters. It's a really fascinating call. I hope you enjoy it, and I would love to hear from you about any thoughts, questions, or comments you have. You can email me, info@yogateachertelesummit.com, or head over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/yogatelesummit. Enjoy the call, and I'll see you on the other side.
Hello and good morning or good afternoon or good evening wherever you are. This is Tal Ratcliffe here. It's 11 a.m. In San Francisco. I am on the line live with Susanna Harwood Rubin and very excited about today's call about why myth matters. And looking forward to being with all of you for the next hour or so. And I'd like to request respectfully that, you know, as much as possible, you give your attention to this call, even though I know we're all probably near computers or on computers, you're very tempting to, you know, check your email and do your Facebook and do a lot of other things. But there's definitely something about allowing your attention to be single-minded and singly focused that can really yield more benefits. So if you're taking the time to listen and be on this call, I think it's going to really benefit you to close away as many other distractions as you possibly can. So first of all, I just want to welcome all of you to the call and welcome Susanna. So thank you so much for joining us, Susanna. And Susanna and I were just chatting. We figured it's probably been about 10 years since we met. I mean, it's definitely 10 years. We're just not sure the exact date. But I think it's over 10 years at this point, probably. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, about 10 and a half. Yeah.
Yeah, you can say about 10 and a half. And we were both drawn to meet each other through studying with Douglas Brooks, who is definitely an inspiration for everything you're going to hear in this call, I believe it's fair to say. Because
absolutely.
Douglas, yeah. So I'm sure Susanna had her own relationship with myth before meeting Douglas, and I know I had my own relationship with myth. It was Douglas who really opened me up in a way to the power of myth in a way that it related directly to my life and to what's possible for not just my life, but for the life of all people on the planet in a way that was really profound, that these myths are really stories about, and as Susanna's going to get into, you know, what is the nature of our consciousness and how do we evolve and how do we engage with our experience, you know, moment to moment and over the course of our lives. And so these stories are so much more than we often think of them as we're raised in our Western world, where myths are kind of somewhat diminished in their power because they're not quote unquote true. You know, whereas in the tradition we study, it's because they're not, you know, true in that way we often think about like science and history. It's because they're, you know, the definition that I've heard, and Santa, correct me if I got it a little wrong, but it's a conscious lie told in the service of a deeper truth, a truth that's not accessible through simple observation in a scientific way or through like recording of history, but actually these truths that are very core to the essence of who we are as human beings and evolving spiritual beings. And just on a personal note, you know, I spoke about this a little bit yesterday, and as we all know, yesterday was September 11th, just for those who listen to the recording and don't have a sense of date. So yesterday was September 11th, 2012, and it's been 11 years since the events of September 11th, you know, 2001, that all of us remember, and especially those of us that were in New York City, and I was, and, you know, I know that it changed my life dramatically, and I'll never forget, you know, that day and what happened that day. And the thing that's important for me to remark on is not just that event itself, as horrible as it was and as tragic as it was in so many ways, because the reality is events like that and similar to that are going on all the time on this planet and have been happening for thousands of years, you know, on different scales. And what it really speaks to me about is the need for our own consciousness to evolve. And, you know, I spoke about this movie Samsara that I saw, and I highly, highly recommend that everyone go see this movie Samsara, but go prepared for some hard visual, you know, and consciousness lessons in a way about what you're going to see. It's not easy to watch. But what it reveals to me is that the the stories we're telling ourselves about who we are as human beings and what we're here for on this planet are very, very mistaken. And that the systems we're creating based on that kind of, or you could call them deluded, like, you know, in the sense of the veils of Maya are very thick, I think, for a lot of the systems that we put into place on this planet so that we can, you know, engage as human beings in certain ways. But they're not at all in line with what we know to be true from our studies of yoga and from our studies of our own consciousness. And so I think these stories and these myths can actually really benefit all of us who are listening to this call, all of our students, and then these ripple effects, I think, can help us create new systems of how we are living and working and relating on this planet in ways that are the kinds of ways we'd like to see for our children and grandchildren, our nieces and nephews, our brothers and sisters, our parents, you know, everyone that we know. I think we can all say that we'd like to see things be even better in the future than they are now. And it's the stories we tell ourselves that create the actions that lead to the kind of world that we live into and manifest. So I don't think you can overemphasize the importance of the myths that we study and believe and live into in our lives, because it's just the impact of that is endless, really. And it really is the stories that we tell ourselves are some of the most important, really the only things that matter, because all we're ever doing is telling stories. And I think these myths are ways to access stories that can really create a shift for us in our lives and for our students, and I do, you know, ultimately for this whole human experiment on this planet that is, you know, once such a mystery and such a miracle, and also, you know, full of so much challenge and opportunity right now for us. So with that, I'm gonna give it over to Susanna to speak a little bit about her, you know, background and experience in this realm of myth, and then she's going to tell us one story to start, and then we'll have some opportunity for feedback and comments if you have. So please, you know, listen with an attentive ear, and if there's something that comes up that you'd love to share, we'd love to hear from you, if you want to make these calls interactive as well. That's why we do them live. So, Susanna, with that, welcome. Thanks so much for joining, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to share today.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tal. I haven't given one of these talks in a while with you, but it's so much fun, and I'm really happy to be here online with you and with everybody else. And myth is something that is really dear to my heart, and it is interesting because I've been telling a Ganesh story all week at my classes at Vira Yoga where I teach, and it's not one of the ones I'm telling today, telling a different one, but I've been telling the Ganesh creation myth, and a great part of that myth, and if you don't know it, don't worry, it's an easy one to find, but a lot of it is about transformation and embracing transformation and moving into new places, and as Tal was saying, we were just talking about the fact that we both met, you know, 10 years ago, and it was really sort of after 10 and a half years ago or so, 9/11, that so many of us dove into our yoga practices in New York, because it was so, it was that love for community and that need for understanding and that really doing the yoga, figuring out what matters, what's important, what's truly of value. And so I've been telling the story about creation and sort of out of a difficulty, out of pain, sort of creating something beautiful. And there are so many times that I feel that a story, a myth, gets at that in a way that we can't, because we, you know, we're limited in terms of language, and language evokes, but a story can evoke on a metaphorical level and tell us, as Tal mentioned, greater truths about our lives than simply saying, I feel like this or I'm thinking that. We tell a story and another world comes to life that reflects back on us and shows us something about our humanity, about who we are. So when I'm thinking about why myth exists, and of course I think Tal said some beautiful things about it, but you know, they myths teach. They offer us lessons, they instruct, they also entertain. Like, it's a fun way. You know, if someone says, memorize this thought versus telling you a story with a thought encapsulated in it, for most of us, or many of us, definitely myself, the way I'm going to remember that thought is through the context of a story. If someone asks me to memorize a bunch of facts, that's going to be tougher. But if they're wrapped up in a narrative, because we do tell stories, it's all said every day, you know, everything we do is telling ourselves a story about what just happened or what's about to happen. So we live through story. We live through myths. So we might as well kind of harness them, draw them in, hold them close, and see what they tell us about ourselves. and see how they reveal different aspects of who we are to ourselves. So they get missed at points in a way that is simultaneously captivating and instructive. They serve as metaphors for our lives. They serve as metaphors for our psyches, for our experiences. They invite us into our own experience in a way that is simple recitation of I did this, I did that, this is what happened today, doesn't. They also myths also carry the wisdom and the values of a culture, so many cultures. And what's always so interesting, if you've ever read Joseph Campbell or listened to Joseph Campbell, is who's written so articulately, of course, is so famous for talking about myth, is, you know, he goes cross-culturally and he takes a myth from one culture and another culture and another culture, and they're all getting at the same essential point of being human, but they're completely different parts of the world, you know, these myths are coming from. And that's sort of the sweetness of it. It's like we're all just trying to get to the center of our humanity and see what things are about and create meaning. And so myths help us to create meaning and show us also what we care about, what we value, what is meaningful. So in terms of my background and why I'm talking about myths, I mean, a lot of it's all that. I definitely have learned so much. I mean, what I know about Hindu myth, which is obviously what we're talking about today, and yoga-related stories, I really learned primarily through my teacher, Douglas Brooks, who is a teacher of both Tal and myself. And I've been studying with him for about 10 and a half years. I met him January of 2002, I guess, yeah. So I know a lot through him. I know a lot through my own research, my own reading, my own, you know, I can get obsessed with one myth and find 10 different versions of it on the internet, which I actually really suggest doing because it's really fun. And you learn a lot from that, but a lot is from Douglas as well. And the tradition that I'm operating in is Rajanika Tantra. It's a tantric tradition. And it, so the stories that I tell, I look at from that point of view. So just as, you know, someone who studies classical yoga or Advaita Vedanta can tell the same story, but from their point of view, this is sort of my take on it. So the story is the story, but everyone who tells a story tells it from their perspective through the veil of their own sensibility. So that's how I will be doing it, just to be very clear about that. Long before I ever studied any of the Hindu myths, when I was really little, I was crazy about ancient Greek and Roman mythology. My sister and I, my older sister and I, would our mother would bring us to the library, and we were voracious readers. We were fairly TV deprived, for which I still thank my parents to this day, because it meant we read like crazy. So we went to the library. I recall it as being about once a week, and we would carry out these stacks of books, and I can remember finding all of these books on the Greek and Roman gods. And my sister and I were obsessed with them. We'd be swapping. We'd each take out a stack of books, and we'd swap back and forth and read them all, like sprawled out, you know, out in the grass in the summer, inside, you know, in a house during the cooler weather. And I remember just having this sense of wonder about them. And then finally, in junior high school, in high school, when I actually studied them more formally, they were still just as wondrous to me. I also love things like Alice in Wonderland. Like, when you think about children's literature, it's very much aligned with myth. And because there is that sense of wonder and that real facility that children have to suspend their disbelief. So we can, the sort of the veil is thinner when you're a child and you can access sort of your access or your mythic consciousness in this simple way. You're not thinking about it that way, but you're like, you're playing make-believe, you're playing dress-up, you're doing all these things. So I think that love of myth, if you begin to learn them early on, they really take root, whether it's a fairy tale or whether it's a story about Zeus or Aphrodite, you know. So that's sort of where my love of myth began. And then when I started studying the Hindu myths, particularly with Douglas, I fell completely in love with them and found them deeply meaningful. So the way to hear myths, this is what's important. So the stories can just be stories. We can just enjoy them. They're fun. They're pretty. You know, they're great. They're playful, or they're scary, or they're interesting. But there is a way to hear myths if you really want to think about why myth matters and how you want to apply them to your life. So you need to hear the myth as if all the characters are you. You need to listen to the story as if it's taking place inside of you. So it's actually more work. Now, there are times when you just want to listen to a story and have fun. And there are times when you want to just read a story and have fun. But then there are other times where you want to read it and draw it within, really bring it inside yourself, so that you can figure out what it means to you. Like, why is this why has this been handed down for 2,000 years, you know, or why has this been handed down for a couple hundred years? Like, why does this story matter? Why does this myth matter? To this point, I had the first teacher who ever really told me this is how you need to read a story was my first philosophy professor, and it happened to be in high school. And believe it or not, we were reading Nietzsche. Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. It was kind of a geeky high school class. And he told us emphatically, I am going to ask all of you to read this book as if it's happening inside yourself. Everything in the book is inside of you. This is how you need to read it. And I think I was, you know, 17 at the time or something, maybe 16. It was something crazy to be reading at that age, but it changed my life permanently. I mean, and I have to say, it took twice as long to read the book as it would have if I were just reading it objectively. But I had to keep stopping and saying, well, what does this mean inside of me? Who is this character inside of me? When this person says this, or when this writer, when Nietzsche is saying X, what does that mean within myself? And it took a long time to read, but I realized this is a completely different learning experience than what I've ever had before. It completely changed my life because it was the practical application of a text to my inner life. And I'd never consciously done that before, although it had been, you know, fed to me my whole life, you know, and I made believe I might have been Alice in Wonderland, but this is the first time I was like, this is happening inside of me. And I read differently after that, and I listened differently after that, and I have to say I even looked at art and heard music differently after I read that book like that. So this is the invitation of myth, I believe. This is, how can we draw it inside and make it come alive within us so that within our bodies, within our minds, within our hearts, we're telling this story that helps us to dive even more deeply into the essence of who we are as individuals and as humans. So collective identity and individual identity. So with that, I have a story that I'd like to tell. And I want to give just a tiny bit of backstory, because it's a Ganesh story. And Ganesh, just for, I would imagine that most people listening know this, but in case they don't, Ganesh is the elephant-headed god. He has the head of an elephant and a body of sort of like a chubby baby boy. So, and there's a whole story about how he got his head. But that's not the one I'm going to tell today, because that's the one that most people know, and I decided to tell a story that isn't quite as well known. So some of you may know it, and some of you may not. So once upon a time, there was a demon by the name of Gajamukha. And like Ganesh, Gajamukha had the face of an elephant and the body of a human. So he had this appearance, this like sort of bizarre appearance, as a result of a curse, which is, of course, is a whole other story. And because he had been cursed to look like this with the elephant face, he was bitter and angry about it. And this bitterness and this anger and the fact that he had been cursed made him demonic. So Gajamukha was actually a demon. So Gajamukha would lament his appearance every time he saw his reflection, and he became angry, bitter, ferocious, and people would run from him in fear. People would avoid him. They would run from him. They didn't want to be around him. He was terrifying. He was unpleasant. So everyone observed, of course, that he looked like the great elephant-headed god Ganesh, but that Ganesh was so sweet-tempered. What was wrong with Gajamukha? That like Ganesh was sweet and fun and playful and honest and straightforward and reliable, and Gajamukha was this sort of dark, evil, angry being. So they shunned Gajamukha. He was so unpleasant to be around, and this made Gajamukha even angrier. And of course, he overheard them talking about him and comparing him to Ganesh. So it was very, very difficult for him. Now, Ganesh had received his head from his father and his uncle, so all great gods who loved him. Ganesh's father, of course, is the great Shiva, and his mother, the great Parvati. So although Ganesh and Gajamukha's appearances were the same, the circumstances through which they had acquired their appearances were completely different. So this caused them to see themselves through their own individual circumstances, through the veil of their own experience. So Ganesh saw the world's sweetness. There was this fuss made when he lost his head and this effort to replace it, and it was a gift to him. They loved him so much that they wanted to make sure he had a head. So he loved his head. He loved his appearance because it was the result. It was the product of love. Whereas Gajamukha received it as a product of a curse, of anger, of dislike, of hatred. So Gajamukha saw the world as unfair and malevolent. So here you have two beings who look completely alike, who have very different perspectives due to their experience. So the more people compared the two, the more resentful and bitter Gajamukha became. So he would brood, he would obsess. He was so ferociously jealous of this other being who looked just like him, but he was so happy and loving and playful and adored by everyone. And he just got into this cycle of anger that he couldn't get out of. So finally, he began to challenge Ganesh to a fight. He was needling him and trying to insult him. And Ganesh would just laugh it off and say, oh, Gajamukha, you know, you're so funny. Don't worry. Come on, relax. Let's have some fun together. Because, of course, Ganesh wasn't scared of Gajamukha. He got along with everyone. Ganesh is adorable. He's the most beloved of all the gods. And the more Ganesh was sweet to him, the more angry Gajamukha would become. And so Gajamukha said, no, we need to fight. I'm going to challenge you to a wrestling match. And Ganesh said, oh, Gajamukha, relax. Here, have one of my sweets. Have one of my modicum, one of his favorite types of sweets. He handed one of his beautiful little round balls of like honey and butter sweets. And this made Gajamukha even more enraged. And he insisted on fighting. So finally Ganesh said, well, okay, if you insist on fighting and that's really what's going to make you happy, I'll agree to fight you. So we will fight. So the fight began. Gajamukha and Ganesh were gripped, rolling on the ground, making a mess. And of course, they have this heaviness. They have heavy bodies and big elephant heads. So the ground is shaking and things are going all over the place. And people are a little bit nervous because they don't know what's going to happen. Because Gajamukha is powerful. He's a demon. But Ganesh, of course, is the lord of the thresholds. He is the remover of obstacles. He's also a very, very powerful god. So they're tumbling and wrestling. But what's strange is Gajamukha suddenly realizes that Ganesh, despite his size and his awkward appearance, is rapid and agile. Even though he has this heavy belly, he can dodge and dart and move and dance. And is laughing as he wrestles Gajamukha. He dazzles Gajamukha with his deft moves, and he finally breaks off one of his own tusks and uses it to pin down Gajamukha's ear. So he has these huge flapping elephant ears. Gajamukha is completely pinned to the ground. His ear is pinned with Ganesh's tusk. And first he struggles a little bit and then just gives up. And he feels completely defeated. Gajamukha acknowledges, you are a greater being than I am. And Ganesh releases him finally. He takes out his tusk and says, Gajamukha, what do you really want? And of course, this is one of the great questions of yoga. What is it that you really want? And Gajamukha pauses and says, I'm sorry, I was angry, I was jealous, and you are clearly superior to me. Despite your size, you are rapid, you are agile, but you move with this incredible dignity and grace. You're regal, like a prince. How do you do it? How can I acquire these qualities? And Ganesh says, well, you have to love yourself. And Gajamukha says, could I at least, in your greatness, become your servant? All I ask is that you allow me to serve you. You are definitely greater than I am, and I've been wrong, and I've wronged you deeply. And Ganesh responds, oh, Gajamukha, you don't need to be my servant. You understand now. You need to figure out what you want. You need to learn to love yourself. I would love to be your teacher. I could show you how to embrace who you are. I could show you how to love your life. And then Ganesh pauses and thinks for a moment because he's a thoughtful being. And he says, I have a wonderful idea. And he says to Gajamukha, I'm going to show you what I'm going to do. And he magically waves his huge arms and he turns him into Musika, a tiny, adorable little mouse who embodies all of the qualities that Gajamukha loved and coveted. Musika is rapid. He's agile. He can scurry around. He can slip through doorways. He can run and jump and do all kinds of little things that Gajamukha didn't think that he was able to do. So he's tiny and adorable, and he becomes Ganesh's constant companion. So Gajamukha is thrilled. Ganesh has helped him to transform through a blessing rather than a curse. So just as Ganesh received his head out of love, Gajamukha has now received his new appearance out of love. And I didn't mention the being, but Gaja means elephant, Mukha means face, so he's called elephant face. But now he's turned into Musika, the little mouse. And his appearance is bestowed through love, so they become good friends. And Gajamukha is now delighted to be Musika. They are constant companions, and they are almost always pictured together. So when you look at iconography of Ganesh and you see that little mouse or rat, whatever you want to call it, that is Musika, formerly Gajamukha. So sometimes Musika sits at Ganesh's feet, and other times Ganesh rides on top of them or bounces on top of the little mouse while dancing. So because Ganesh, of course, knows his own abilities, and he knows that he can do pretty much whatever he wants to. He has everything he needs. They complement each other now with their different appearances and their predominant traits and gifts. So now the question is, why does this myth matter? So it's pretty clear from the story what it's about and what this means within us, but I want to talk about it a little bit more deeply. Gajamukha, the elephant face, and Ganesh are essentially the same being, but they're born of different experiences. So they see the world through different veils, different lenses. So think about this. Two people are in the same place in their lives, but one has gotten there through adversity. One has gotten there through love and good fortune. And you know that those two people often have a different way of looking at the world. They perceive the world differently. Everything we know is built out of our own individual stories, as well as the cultural collective stories that we share. So your story is what creates who you are and the lens through which you see the world. And this is what's happened with these two. So this story reminds us of that. Our perspective on something is the sum of our experiences. And the minute we own that, the minute we recognize that, we are more able to shift things when we need to. Here's another point. Ganesh participates in this struggle with Gajamukha in order to go through it with him. He becomes his companion, as well as his teacher, who assists him in his transformation. Ganesh is all about transformation. When we look at Ganesh, here's a creature mid-transformation. He represents transformation within his very appearance, with the elephant head and the human body. So he is that one who's going to bring us from one place into another. This time of year, I love to teach about Ganesh because we're moving slowly into the fall season. This is about transition. This is about stepping through doorways. Ganesh is the Lord of the Thresholds. He sits in the doorway. He represents that sense of transformation within us as we move from one place into another, one season into another, one way of thinking about ourselves into another way of thinking about ourselves and perceiving who we are in the world. So he tries through sweetness to teach him, and it doesn't work. He tries through laughter to teach him, and it doesn't work. And he finally has to get ferocious. And you know that sometimes you need to get ferocious with those you love. Because Ganesh loves Gajamukha. He knows he's wounded. He wants to help him. So finally, the ferocity, the roughness, the dirtiness, the wrestling, the winning, is the thing that speaks to Gajamukha. And Gajamukha recognizes the sweetness. So Ganesh is wise enough to keep meeting Gajamukha where Gajamukha is. And then Ganesh helps to guide him over the threshold into a new sense of who he is, a new perspective on his own struggle. Ganesh is a model on how to serve as a teacher and as a guide to people in our lives. So we can't always choose our circumstances, but we can choose what we're going to do about it. We can choose how we're going to align with what is, what's handed to us. How do you receive the world? This is the question. How do you receive the world? And the next question is, how do you want to receive the world? What are you going to do about it? Because it is your inner world that determines your outer vision. Ganesh allows Gajamukha his own experience. He lets him come to it by himself. And this is how we need to learn. This is how we need to let others learn. We don't tell children, just do this, and expect them to get it. Sometimes we do that because we need to do it. But if you've ever worked with kids, if you have a kid, you know, you can tell them, tell them, tell them, but there's a certain point at which you know that they have to learn it for themselves. So Ganesh just follows alongside of him, and when he's ready to learn, he's there for him. We're like this, too. We know this. We know we need to learn. We know we need to change. But we can't always do it. We know that there's a time when we'll finally pass through that doorway. So Ganesh invites us to see ourselves differently. Ganesh invites us to peer within and see the sense of possibility in our own lives. That, for me, if we have thoughts about that, I'd love to hand it back to Tal or hand it to people who have comments, questions, things that they want to add on to the story. So that is our first story today. So, Tal, I don't know if you have any perspective on that or if you want to add to it.
I'm Well, I definitely feel like that, that there's definitely something for us as yoga practitioners, students, teachers, wherever we are in that spectrum, to learn from a story that has some ferocity in it, in a way, you know, and to remember that that is as important as the receptivity and you know, openness and more kind of yin kind of qualities of a teacher is to sometimes be kind of fierce and kind of meet people where they're at so that they can get the lesson that they're actually really wanting. And, you know, I know for myself at least that's been, and also as a man, you know, in like the yoga world, it's like predominantly, you know, women. And just that sometimes not having that energy can be unhealthy, you know, for a system. If there's not people who are like holding strong boundaries and kind of giving people the container that they need to develop, you know.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. I think that sometimes there's this idea in the yoga community that we have to be just like sweetness and niceness and passivity. And there is, I mean, if you look at the stories, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, it takes place on a battlefield. And Krishna is telling Arjuna, you better take up arms and fight. You need to do what's right. Arjuna doesn't want him. He's like, get in there and fight. Do your yoga. And I agree with you. I think there's this idea, and I think it does happen a lot with men in the yoga world, too, that, like, you need to tame your ferocity sort of thing. And with women, too, I mean, with all of us. But definitely it's kind of, it's often ferocity is seen as being negative. And in a story, it's the thing. It's the heat. It's the tapas that creates transformation. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that one. Yeah.
Hey, I have a great idea. Since we have this amazing system that allows us to break up into small groups, what if we just broke up into small groups of like four people? So those of you listening in, be prepared to speak. You don't have to speak, but it'd be nice if you did. And we'll just do like, you know, three to 4 minutes. We'll see how it goes. And Susanna and I will kind of be roving around, kind of eavesdropping and maybe participating. But you'll be just placed into a group with other people on this call. You can introduce yourselves, say where you're from, and why don't you share about what you got out of this story, out of this myth. And one of the things I really like to do with these calls is to connect us to each other in this community, and that's one of the cool things about this this system. So if you are somewhere super loud, maybe put your phone on mute and just quickly say, hey, I can't really talk because I'm on mute. But otherwise, I'm going to set us into groups of four. And you're going to, that's going to happen in just a moment. So here we go. One, two, three. So you should be in your groups now. Please introduce yourselves and share anything you learned from this myth or any inquiry you have around it. And Suzanne and I will be roving around listening in. And if you need help, hit four on your keypad. Okay.
Tal, do I do that too? I'm Suzanne on the keypad. Oh, I don't do anything. Okay.
everyone, it's Tal, and I'm just curious if you'd like another minute or two if you're ready to wrap it up. So if you're ready to wrap it up, hit 1. If you'd like another minute, hit 2. And if you want another 2 minutes, hit 3. And that way I can get a sense of where we're going to go here next, kind of somewhat democratically. All right, it looks like we're ready to wrap it up. So I'm just going to give you 20 seconds to say goodbye to your groups, and then we'll come back together as a full group and see if anyone has anything in particular they want to share. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next story, which I know Suzanne is excited to share. So take another 20 seconds to share with each other, and we'll come back together.
Please bring your conversation to a close. This breakout session is now ending.
Okay, so I hope I didn't cut anyone off. It's a little hard to manage when there's so many different groups happening at the same time. I can't listen to all of them to see if you're all done, but just trust that everyone you're in the group with really appreciated what you had to say, even if they didn't have a chance to say that, because I know that to be true. So, Susanna, I know you got to listen in a couple of groups. We didn't get to get to all of them, but I know that I jumped around a little bit and heard people having really good talks. So I hope everyone found that valuable. I'd love to know if you did. You can email me at info@yogateachertelephone.com and just let me know what you think about the breakouts. And I think they're really great, so I just want to make sure that you do, too.
Yeah. And I also, it makes things a lot more interesting when I'm listening to other people's experiences and how they think about these things and apply them. So I actually really enjoy listening in. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Story.
Absolutely.
Are we ready for another story?
We all learn so much from each other. Yeah. So it's about 45 minutes in. Do we want to see if anyone has something they want to share to the whole group that they discuss? Or if you want to save that for the end, do you want to tell your next story now? Let's do the next story.
Afterwards we'll have some time. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to shift gears. And I told Tal, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to tell 4 stories. And I'm like, who am I kidding? When I was thinking about this and planning about it, I was like, I'll be lucky if I get through 2. So here's another story. And I have backup stories too, but these are the 2 main ones I want to teach. I really fleshed out. So this one, we're going to move from Ganesha. I always like to begin with him because, of course, he's at the threshold, into Krishna. Now, when we talk about Krishna stories, stories about baby Krishna, stories about Krishna as lover, stories about the Krishna of the Bhagavad Gita, who's a statesman, and stories about Krishna who conquers demons. So the Krishna stories are really vast. There's so many of them, and I know more Krishna stories than anything else. So I knew I wanted to tell one, and I kept changing my mind, but I settled on the baby Krishna one that I thought, in some ways connects to the first story, but it's quite different as well. But I think this one is particularly sweet. So in terms of a little backstory, Krishna is born of the gods Vasudeva and Rohini, but he's hidden away in a cowherding village because of a threat to his life. So this is very much like kind of like the Superman story, and which I think, you know, these are all archetypes, you know, so we have them in different mythic traditions. But so that he's not hurt or damaged, he's hidden away by his parents in a cow herding village. And he's raised by his foster parents, Yashoda and Nanda. And he loves them dearly. So for the purposes of simplicity, I'll refer to his mother, because she's in the story, I'll refer to his foster mother, Yashoda, as his mother. So he's raised in a very, very ordinary, everyday way. In a cowherding village where, you know, so there are always lots of, he loves butter and milk. He loves all the things that a cow produces. Very humble little village. But, of course, he has, you know, he basically has superpowers. So every once in a while something strange happens. So baby Krishna, just like the Krishna's lover, loves attention. He loves to be tended to. He's adorable. He's irresistible. Krishna is always the one who is irresistible. So once upon a time, Krishna's mother, Yashoda, goes to the market to buy what she needs for the week and to also sell her milk products. So she takes out her cart. She tucks baby Krishna very neatly and snugly underneath the cart and fills it with butter, with curd, which is yogurt, and milk, and rolls off to the marketplace. When they get to the market, Yashoda is immediately involved in all of the wild, like the crazy energy of the marketplace. She's buying things that she needs for the week. She's selling the milk and some of the curd and some of the butter. And she's just far too busy to pay attention to Krishna. So he's just snuggled underneath in his blanket. He's a little teeny baby in the story. But Krishna is fussing. He's gurgling. And he keeps trying to get her attention. He's reaching one little arm out to her, but he's lying on his back looking up at all everything in the marketplace at Yashoda. But no matter what he does, he cannot get her attention. So he cries, he thrashes around in his blanket. Nothing is getting her attention. So this should sound a little bit familiar to our Ganesh story at this point. He's doing whatever it takes to get her attention. So Yashoda is very, very busy with her chores, so she kind of ignores him and half-hears him anyway. You know, he's a child, and they're in the market. She needs to do what she needs to do. So in the middle of the bustling activities of the marketplace, no one else pays attention to him either. So there he is, baby Krishna, frustrated as can be. So he gathers up all of his power, and he kicks with all of his strength and overturns the entire heavy butter cart. So milk and curd and butter run everywhere, all over the ground, all over the floor of the marketplace, and all over Krishna. He's coated. He's soaked in all of his little swaddling clothes, and the pans and the bowls are scattered. Some are broken, and it's a complete disaster. But here's the thing. No one can figure out how the butter cart has been overturned. It's a huge, heavy cart, and Krishna is a little baby. So no one suspects him because he can't even walk yet. How could Krishna possibly do it? So they're worried. They don't know what has happened. They're trying to figure out who has created all this destruction and who has tried to hurt Krishna. And the only ones who have witnessed what happened are the little children in the market who are down low enough to hear Krishna's cries and to see him as he overturned the cart. So they are fascinated. And they're shocked. They can't believe that this has happened, what they've seen. Because they've basically seen a god, you know, using superhuman strength to do something that no other baby could ever do. So they run to tell the Brahmins, like the temple priests, the wise men of the village, what they saw, because that's who you go to. And the Brahmins, of course, are completely skeptical because they're logical. And they know that a baby could not possibly or logically have caused this occurrence. So no one believes the children. So Krishna isn't punished at all for this moment of incredible destruction. Instead, Yashoda and the others around her rush to take care of Krishna because he's fallen to the ground and is drenched in milk and butter and curd. So Yashoda picks him up. Everyone fusses. She peels all of the wet cloths out off of him. Well, the children are trying to tell everyone what happened, and no one is listening to them. And she wraps him in fresh cloth. And once tended to, of course, he's completely happy again. He's cooing. He's smiling. He is, as he should be, the center of attention. Why? Because he's Krishna. He is a god. He is the very fabric of the universe with all of its messiness and imperfection. So even though he's a child, he knows that he's the most important part in this story. And he knows that the focus should be, rightfully, on him. So here's a story that you really need to draw all the characters within. Our last story, we really only had two. But this one, we have an entire marketplace. So what is this about? Why does this myth matter? In the story, the divine, namely Krishna, is hidden under the trappings of everyday life. The divine is put to the side and not tended to, which is part of our experience. We can't go around all the time, you know, chanting or praying, you know, or being grateful for our lives. You know, we have to get the groceries. We have to, you know, run to, you know, catch the subway if you live in New York City the way I do, or like get to your car or teach class or go to your job or cook for your family or, you know, whatever you need to do. We're distracted by the things that we need to do in everyday life. Yet, what we need to recognize is that beneath that is the divine. This is if you live the life of a householder as opposed to the life of a renunciate who wants to go off in a cave and meditate, well, then you're living fully in that place. But I don't think anyone on this call is doing that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have a computer or a phone. So So if you're living the life of a householder, as we all are, how do you constantly, beneath the trappings of everyday life, find that sense of beauty, of truth, of sweetness, of divinity? That's what the story is telling us. It's saying refocus. We can undervalue the divine, we can ignore it, we can place it to the side, we can tuck it underneath something. But when we least expect it, and in the most outrageous and unexpected and unpredictable ways, we get a wake-up call. The divine is hidden in plain sight. This is something I also want to mention. My teacher Douglas talks about all the time, about the divine being hidden in plain sight. Because it's not a tradition, the tradition that I study with him, or Jataka Yoga, is not a tradition where, you know, we're wearing it on our sleeve. I'm not walking around in saffron robes, you know, I'm not saying like I'm so divine, you know. I'm a student of life, just like everyone, just like we all are, you know. So if you can manage to, beneath the conversation, beneath the chores, beneath everything else, have that sense of, you know, seeing the divine in all things, in all places, life becomes richer. And this story is about that little wake-up call, that little reminder to always look for that. Krishna's going to get us to see this no matter what. He's going to work his charm. He's going to coax. He's going to demand. He's going to cajole. He's going to yell. He's going to scream. He's going to overturn the cart. Whatever it takes to get us there, to wake us up, to get us to look at what's of value, he's going to do that. So the butter and the milk are gone, but what really matters is tended to. You know, Yashoda's attention, her intentions, rather, are good. She treasures her baby. You know, she's tucked him carefully underneath the cart. And Krishna knows that. Krishna knows her values are in the right place, but he's just reminding her. It all works out. And we are every single character, of course, in the story. So we are Yashoda, who's trying to do the right thing. We are the children who often see and understand things that adults don't, because they are not as bound by logic and duty. They're not as bound by dharma, by the obligatory things, the nityas, the obligatory things of daily life that we have to do, like, you know, make our meal, go to work, pick up the kids, all those things. So the kids have this certain access to the divine available a little bit thinner. They can access these things more easily. So we are them as well. We are also the Brahmins. We apply knowledge and wisdom to a situation, and we try to look at it logically. We are the marketplace, with all of our busyness, our activities, our frenzy, sometimes our chaos, but a deep sense of order and, you know, tending towards our daily business. And, of course, we are also Krishna, who knows what is of real value and will work to realize it. So we hold all the characters inside ourselves. We hold the landscape of the story inside ourselves. We are all of these things. We are as divine as anything else. Krishna lore often shows us that the divine is present in every way possible and in every form possible. So we need to ask ourselves these questions. How deeply do you wish to experience the divine? And how do you actually find the divine in everyday life? And then, lastly, can you make your experience divine? So how deeply do you want to experience the divine? That's a question we have to ask ourselves every day. And then we behave accordingly. So how do we find it in everyday life? How do we look at, like, our paperwork, you know, the things we have to do, and still say, like, beneath that, there's something, there's beauty, there's the divine, there's something connected to the rest of the world, there's the universe. And finally, can we make our experience divine? So if we're waiting for the divine to happen to us, we need to instead flip that around and go and find the divine in our daily lives. So that's what the story is about, and that's where we go with it. So I think I brought us up to about, you know, just a few minutes before 3 o'clock. But I'd love to sort of, I don't know how you want to structure this, but, you know, have a discussion about those questions. What does this story mean for you? Like, how experiencing the divine, how do you look for it in your life? You know, everyone talks about it. Poets talk about it. You know, Walt Whitman talks about this. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like one of those universal wisdom tradition questions, you know, and definitely there's a lot that story resonates for me around, but I'd love to hear, maybe we'll do a more open discussion this time, if people can hit one on their keypad and share about their reflections. I think that'd be really nice for everyone to hear. You know, the small groups are great too, and it's also great for everyone to hear, you know, some people's thoughts. So if you have a a comment on this story or a question or an inquiry or something that it brings up for you or something you'd like to share, please hit 1 on your keypad. And just imagine it's like a small group, because it's really just a bigger small group, you know, that you're sharing with. And it'll just benefit everyone to hear your perspective. Great. So, Ariel, you are unmuted. So, welcome. Thank you for raising your hands and sharing.
Well, I live in the tropics. I live in what they call paradise. And indeed, it really is beautiful here. It's tropical, and yet it's everyday life, too. You know, I'm still going to the grocery store. I'm still teaching classes. I'm still getting gas for my car. So there's all of that. But I don't know, in the last, I'd say, year or so, I've just been so aware of just the miraculousness of all of the many, many, many kinds of plants, the many kinds of bugs, the many kinds of flowers, that there's just such a diversity, and there is just so much creativity everywhere that I look, creativity that came from someplace. And that's what's keeping me in awe right now. It's like, how did we get, how did it come to be that we have all of these different kinds of palm trees, all of these different birds? How was that? How is that? So maybe with the myths, we get a chance to get some direction from that, because it really is a miracle. Wherever I look, it's a paradigm shift that's happening in my life right now.
Yeah. I think that's so beautiful. Also, because it is funny when you slow down enough just to remember. And I often feel that for me personally, these myths are reminders in a way, especially this one. I think it's why I love the story. It's a reminder to look for the divine. Like you're saying, like you can look at like, and I love the tropics. Although I'm in New York City, I love the tropics. And when I'm there, I feel that sense of wonder as well. Like just the richness, the effulgence of nature. It's so wondrous to me that I get that hit of the divine. It's easier for me in some ways to access than it is where I live in New York. But so I have to remind myself through stories and stuff to have a sense of wonder as I move through my day. Thank you. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you, Ariel.
Yeah.
So the next person who, I say raising your hand, that's what it looks like on my screen, just so you know, I'm not just metaphorical, but it's Mary. I don't have your last name on the screen, but thanks for joining us. We'd love to hear you share.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying the talks and the stories. And, you know, you were just talking, I was listening to the woman before me, Arielle, was that your name? She was discussing, you know, that she lives in a paradise. And, you know, I think, and this is tough for me as a teacher, because I feel that these awakenings happen at the perfect time, and you have to just wait and be patient, and then something else clears, and, you know, I've always been connected and never wavered with God, but the awakening and the awareness of beauty around me and connection to nature and noticing different beautiful aspects of life and creativity have only come, you know, maybe the last few years, even though I'm teaching so long. So I do feel like we have to be patient with ourselves, and we can look sometimes, keep looking, and I think a big element is just being patient that when it's the right time, and, you know, the divine does also present himself to us on a different level, and then you become aware of all this miraculous beauty and people, and you become more open and compassionate, and all of that just starts flowing. So there's a part of you can look, and you're just not ready to see, and then there's a part of, you know, planting seeds, tell your people just trust because you've kind of been through it, and just keep waiting. And sometimes it just then reveals when it's time. So I wanted to share that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think that receptivity is so key as well. It is funny, like you can't force the divine. I love that idea. You have to sometimes just receive it. Definitely. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, what you talked about in the story as well is, like, we can't force it, and yet we can also create conditions that make it more, you know, likely to manifest, you know, mm-hmm. kind of like the luck is I don't remember the quote exactly, but it's something like luck happens to the people who are best prepared. You know, it's kind of like you don't know when that quote unquote luck is going to happen, but like it's much more likely to happen when you're like really well prepared for the, for the benefits of that event.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that sort of thing with that, with that, you know, having more and more of that vibration of, you know, connectedness and a sense of the miraculous, you know, like, and I feel the same way as Suzanne. It's like, I don't know, you know, and I would love to have like some enlightened master on these calls that maybe can explain what it would be like to be that way. But, you know, it's almost like the forgetting and the remembering seems like it's necessary in order to have the experience, or else it would just be, kind of, it would be undifferentiated.
Yeah.
But that maybe that's my limited understanding. I'm not claiming to really get it.
I agree with you. I think that's part of the sweetness of it, and that's when we talk about Maya and the tantric tradition. We're talking, rather than through ignorance, we're talking about, like, the nature of, like, as, you know, the cloud moving over the sky, you know, blocking out one part of the sky so you can see the rest more clearly, and then it shifts and something else is revealed. And that's the sweetness of, you know, living embodied life. Like, where I'm sitting right now, I can see what's in front of me, but I can't see what's behind my head. And I'm actually really okay with that. You know?
Yeah.
So I can focus on one thing at a time and see more deeply, look more deeply. I think there's like a sweetness to forgetting, because then we get to reconnect and we get to remember. And it's like reading a poem and then rereading it. Like, I get excited when I forget just enough to have a new experience reading it again.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and it's something that I think about is, like, you know, even in those periods of forgetting, how do we create support structures in our lives that allow for those periods of forgetting to have a real, sweet and connected quality to them, you know? And so there's even like our quote unquote lows, and like we're going to have highs and lows in life, but how do we make our lows higher? You know, that there's this upward trend in everything because of our practices and because of our intentionality, and, you know, and also just knowing that there's a level of lila or unpredictability in the universe that we're just going to have to learn how to be a better responder to what comes up in our experience, because we are, you know, ultimately the authors of how we choose to respond to things. And I think these myths are great ways to like learn about lots of different strategies to respond to what comes up, because they're often surprising how people respond or the beings respond. If anyone else has something they'd like to share, please. Please let us know, and you can hit 1 on your keypad. And Mary, thank you, and thanks for joining us. And also, we should mention, Susanna, about your course before we close out.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't you talk about
that? Oh, yeah, there's that, too. Okay, so starting on October, the first Wednesday in October, what is that, the 3rd, starting on Wednesday, October 3rd, I'll be teaching, and this is the third time Tal and I will be doing this together, my course called Writing Your Practice. And I wanted to focus on myth, and it was a fun way of me doing that. But writing your practice, for those who, there might be a couple people online, because I actually wrote to them and said, like, I'm telling a story I didn't tell you guys today. So it's a course that, it's a 10-session course, and it's through the Yoga Teacher Academy with Tal. And it is all about how to use yoga philosophy and myths and stories to drive forward the process of writing. And my knowledge of philosophy, again, comes from my 10.5 years of pretty much incessant study with Douglas Brooks and my several trips to India with him. And I'm happy to say I'll be going again in December. And the course itself, I like write for Elf and Journal, I write for Origin Magazine, I used to write for Social Workout, and my background, I also used to write for a Museum of Modern Art, all kinds of stuff. And so I've always had writing as a huge part of my life, and I was trying to marry the writing to yoga philosophy and really create something with it. And it was a very natural sort of thing that came together, and I realized that, look at the philosophy is something you can apply to any aspect of your life, so why not apply it to the creative process of writing? So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be, I actually love teaching it. We do it via teleconference. We have a Facebook group where people can share writing and get the downloads. And it's completely interactive. But every week I give a talk that's inspired by a different a different philosophical concept or deity. I mean, we really move through like Ganesh and Hanuman and Lakshmi and then other more obscure concepts or more challenging concepts, rather like the rasas, who aren't like a being, but it's an idea. And so there'll be a lot of yoga philosophy, but its purpose is to drive forward the process of writing. So a lot of people have started blogging as a result of it, or people who already did are you know, just deepened it through the acquisition of the philosophy and the discussion and the particular writing tools and tips that we've explored through the course. So, Paul, do you want to add to that at all?
Well, I'll just say, you know, I think it's also really a useful thing, just having this conversation we're having today about why myth matters, that even if you're not somebody that is thinking, oh, I want to be blogging more or writing for, you know, yoga magazines or spirituality magazines or my local paper or whatever, even if that's not on your agenda, but just actually understanding your own experience and your own life and, you know, consciousness in a more profound way, that simply being engaged in writing is one of those ways that can allow things to emerge that don't emerge any other way. And it's just one of the many tools that we have at our fingertips, literally, to explore, you know, who we are. So I think it's a really valuable course to undergo and a journey to undergo with Susanna and your fellow teachers and students of yoga to take these stories in more deeply into your life. And so it can work for you on many different levels, and it's also great if you want to bring your writing out into the world in a bigger way or, you know, write your life story or something for your children or your grandchildren and find a way to frame it. So it's really, it's very adaptable, you know, and our goal is really to make it as useful and accessible to as many people as possible. You know, so it's not for people who are like, I already have written 4 novels, I'm looking to write my 5th, and, you know, want strategic coaching on how to publicize it. Like, this course is not the best fit, you know, but it's really meant for people that want to be in this process of conversation and engagement and exploration and also really enhance their writing if that's something you want to do.
I mean, that's also, it's a really wide range of people who do it, from people who have fear of the blank page, and I do a lot of stuff that very directly addresses writer's block, because I feel like there are lots of tricks I have that pushes that out of the way. And we do it through the philosophy. Then some people write very regularly and blog very regularly but want more of the yoga philosophy, and I do tell a lot of stories and really explain a lot of the philosophy. So there's those people too. And then there are people who are like blogging but need like sort of a community, a point of reference to keep them moving and need to expand their subject matter, or who need to really look at like, how is it that I write? Like, what's my writing about? So it really, I think that's one of the things that's so much fun about it, because it's such a wide range of experience in terms of the people who take it. And it's really,